Now, next week marks the 80th anniversary of one of the most epoch-defining speeches of the post-war years, which Sir Winston Churchill delivered in Fulton, Missouri, with President Harry S. Truman listening intently. The then former British Prime Minister coined two phrases that echoed down the decades. He spoke of a special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States. That was a rhetorical keeper still used today. The Brits fixate about the special relationship. But it was the chilling of Cold War relations between Washington and Moscow that produced the most memorable line.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
An iron curtain. Now, era-defining speechifying seems to be very much back in vogue. We had the Canadian Prime Minister's rupture, not transition speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Vice President J.D. Vance delivered a landmark speech at the Munich Security Conference last year, which placed the transatlantic relationship under intense strain. This week, of course, we had Donald Trump's State of the Union. So, is the set piece speech making a comeback? And what makes an oration truly great? I've been talking with Sarada Perry, a former speechwriter for President Barack Obama. Sarada Perry, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
We often talk about Churchillian speeches. It's become a shorthand almost for a great speech. But why was Churchill such a great speechmaker in your mind?
Well, he, of course, had studied and understood oratory, but I think a couple of things made him distinct. One is that he really tried to understand the moment that he was attempting to meet, and he took a great deal of care in preparing his speeches. He wanted every word to matter and to meet the moment, which I think is actually sort of rare. And the other thing is that I think people have a sense that he was kind of flowery because his language was beautiful, but actually he was quite plain spoken. You know, he spoke in clear terms and he named things very clearly. And he wanted to get to the heart of the matter in a way that I think, especially at the time, you didn't necessarily always hear. Political speeches were quite florid. And it's not that he didn't, you know, go down those pathways and have strong feelings about rhetoric and all of the sort of ancient techniques. But I do think that he was rather plain spoken. And then the last thing I'll say is that I think he was willing to be rather bold and say things honestly in an unvarnished way that often, of course, frustrated and angered people. People disagreed with him. They were very critical. He struggled politically as a result, but he was always consistent and willing to say what he wanted to say, which again, I think is just sort of rare in politics, of course, now, but even then.
As you say, often a speech is considered great because it defines a moment. It encapsulates the thinking of a certain time. It frames things in a way which makes light bulbs go off in people's heads. Is that what happened in Fulton, Missouri with the Iron Curtain speech? People just went, yeah, that's the world we're now living in.
I do think that speech in particular was, again, one of these powerful naming of the moments in a way that not very many people were willing to do. And to do it in America where, you know, at the time, people were sort of done with this idea of having to be involved in a war or in conflict half a continent away. You know, the country was still reeling, not just from the end of the war and all the aftermath, but from the death of FDR and the sort of this new president, newish president, who was finding his footing and not quite sure what he was going to do. I think that in this incredibly vivid naming of the Iron Curtain and the way that Churchill lays out in pretty stark terms this East-West divide was pretty jarring for people. Not everybody, some people agreed, but initially faced a fair amount of criticism, and actually Truman had to kind of waffle a little bit and say, oh, I'm not sure I agree. I didn't know exactly what he was going to say. He knew exactly what he was going to say. But he himself was sort of taken aback. And then, of course, as per usual, whenever Churchill shared whatever wisdom he had, it took people some time to get there. But then ultimately, of course, the way that he framed the moment, as you said, had incredible lasting power. To this day, his speech in Fulton shaped the narrative of how we see the Cold War even today, which is remarkable for someone to have been able to do that.
80 years on, yeah. We've had a lot of memorable speeches recently. This is a particularly historic moment in world affairs. It feels like a real juncture. One speech that has obviously got a lot of attention was delivered by the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney in Davos earlier this month. He's actually addressing the Australian Parliament in Canberra next week. I wonder what you made of the Carney-Davos speech. Why was it considered so good?
It was direct and honest. He named the situation very clearly. As you said, the best speeches are able to capture a moment that often is difficult to capture, especially moments of great complexity when there are so many different converging forces. It's just hard to wrap your arms around them and then offer a sort of rhetorical explanation that not just explains it at an intellectual level, but makes people feel something. And I think that Carney was willing to say very clearly the rupture, this notion of a pleasant fiction, naming of the power of the less powerful, just sort of giving names and an image to this moment that can feel really chaotic. I think that he called out pretty bluntly the people in the room, the sort of Davos class of people who have kind of been capitulating, frankly, to Trump and to the direction that he has taken the world and just gone along to get along. The other thing about it is that it was kind of conversational and it was tight. Even though what he was laying out was a pretty and sort of facing up to this really grim reality that, you know, the institutions that we thought were going to protect us are no longer going to do that, that the middle powers can no longer count on a system that actually is oppressing them, that, you know, we have to stop pretending. Even though it could sound sort of negative, I think there was something really refreshing because he was also giving agency. He was sort of saying, we don't have to just sit here and take the world as people are giving it to us, as these more powerful countries are giving it to us, we can actually create a new reality. We have the capacity to do that. And I think that's actually really powerful and inspiring.
One of the interesting things that struck me about the Carney speech is here is a sort of former central banker who doesn't exactly have a sort of surfeit of charisma. In an age of performative politicians, he is not performative. And it underscores the point that to deliver a great speech, you don't have to be a kind of great political actor.
I think that's incredible, absolutely true. And actually, people often mistake charisma for good speech making. And that is just, they are not the same thing. And you can often see politicians who have a great deal of charisma and charm in certain settings, but actually kind of fail at the big set piece speeches, in part because they don't actually know what they want to say. To deliver a good speech, you have to know who you are, what you are about, what you believe, and then state it really clearly. And I actually think that it's not charisma we want in our speakers, it's credibility.
Middle powers must act together because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu.
A good speech is a good speech. You know, you sort of know when you feel something, you hear it, and it's a good speech. A great speech, the speeches for the ages, the ones that kind of make people stand up, sort of have three things. They have the message that is very compelling, delivered by a speaker with the credibility to deliver that message. But all of that has to meet a moment that demands that speaker with that message. And you can't plan for that. It doesn't come along very often, but I think Carney spotted this moment. And not only the moment, but in the place, in front of this audience. And he really seized it and turned it into something that was maybe unexpected for a politician like him.
Now, you wrote speeches for Barack Obama, widely acknowledged as one of the great presidential orators, a politician who really made his breakthrough on the stage of the Democratic Convention in 2004 with an electrifying speech.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
I wonder what it was like to write speeches for Barack Obama. I mean, obviously, he penned quite a lot of his own addresses, but what was it like to be a speechwriter for him?
Truthfully, it was the best job in the world because he was the epitome of what I'm talking about in terms of a leader who very much knew who he was, had a very clear central idea of why he was in public life and what his project for America was. And because he had that clear narrative. You know, you could draw a straight line from that speech he gave in 2004 at the Democratic Convention in Boston all the way to his farewell address and, frankly, to the speeches that he still gives today in his post-presidential life. He just has a really clear theory of the case. So, of course, he is a rare talent as an actual speaker. He is incredibly charismatic. He's funny. He's brilliant. All of those things. He knows how to deliver a speech. He knows how to reach an audience, connect, change in the moment, react to them, right? He understands that a speech is not a one-way experience. But all of that is only one part of what makes him great. I truly think that the part that makes him masterful and a communicator of, you know, generation is the fact that he knew exactly what he stands for. And so all of that means that whatever speech we were writing, we always knew how to tie it back to that narrative. And that narrative wasn't really about him. It was about America. So any speech we did, whether it was, you know, congratulating a winning sports team or delivering an address to a foreign parliament, it all could connect to the values that he laid out. And so, yeah, it was a rare gift. I feel very lucky.
I think one of the most memorable speeches I heard him give was in Charleston, South Carolina, following the massacre of 9 African Americans at a black church in the city, which was carried out by a white supremacist. And it was because during that eulogy, he launched into song.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
I think that goes back to being able to read the audience. You know, that wasn't a speech I worked on. Our director of speech writing, Cody Keenan, worked on it, and he writes about this in his book, that when they were on the plane landing in Charleston, the president said, you know, I may sing. He wasn't sure. He wasn't sure, you know, he would have to feel the moment, which is, of course, part and parcel of the history of the black church, this really living, breathing organism. And the congregation is alive in this really important, beautiful way. And so he was able to gauge, okay, if I start, will they join me? Because that is the point, right? The grace is something that unites all of us. And so it has to be something that we all do together. And he wasn't sure, but he was able to read the moment and deliver exactly what the congregation needed in this moment of incredible tragedy.
Sarah DePerry, a former senior presidential speechwriter for Barack Obama. Thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
Think bigger about the world we live in. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.